the greenback at bay. In guiding the weakening dollar through its global gauntlet, top U.S. economic officials found themselves facing a new set of foreign economic policy arbiters. The United States had been a net global creditor until the late 1980s, ill-preparing Washington policymakers for the post-2001 surveillance of hard-eyed Asian power elite. The central banks of creditor nations rapidly accumulating large sums of U.S. Treasury debt. As debt-prone Americans ratcheted up their international borrowing in the late 1990s, media attention first ran to short stories, not headlines. In 1997, net U.S. international indebtedness rose to $360 billion, and in 1999, to $1 trillion. The year of the attack on the World Trade Center saw U.S. net international indebtedness reach $2.3 trillion. Thereafter, as we have seen, the total swelled in 2003 to $2.7 trillion and ballooned to $3.3 trillion in 2004, with a 2005 figure in the $4 trillion range. Gradually, the issue of which nations held American debt, for what purposes, and with what risk of potential ambuscades, began to make the front pages, especially in the financial press. Some of the large holders were major U.S. allies. Britain, Canada, and Germany, whose central banks had long kept dollars in reasonable proportions as part of their reserves. The second holders, more problematic, were the major and middling oil-pumping nations collecting a flood of greenbacks from the escalating price of petroleum. These included the OPEC members, as well as Mexico and Russia. According to a survey by the Bank for International Settlements, between 2001 and 2004, OPEC nations dropped the share of their reserves held in dollars from 75% to 61.5%. Major OPEC producers such as Iran and Venezuela held fewer dollars because their hostility to the United States had become overt. But even moderates in OPEC ranks saw the growing wisdom of putting reserves into a wider array of currencies. The collapse of U.S. oil strategy in the botched invasion and occupation of Iraq was a further aggravant. OPEC had been an indirect target of Washington's ambition to open the oil spigots in a subjugated Iraq and drive down oil prices. When the U.S. blueprint miscarried, OPEC appeared to have taken full advantage. For starters, the former oil price band of $22 to $28 per barrel was quietly dropped. Some analysts also concluded that OPEC decision-makers had begun to calculate informally in euros. Logical enough, considering that the European Union was the Middle East producer's biggest customer. Doing so would have allowed the oil price to mirror the sharp rise in the EU currency, albeit the invoices were still in dollars. In December 2004, the survey released by the Bank for International Settlements noted the speculation that OPEC's central bank reductions in dollar holdings prefaced a larger policy move. As we saw in Chapter 3, some OPEC member nations, not just Iran, Iraq under Saddam, and Venezuela, but also Malaysia and Indonesia, were pushing discussions to stop pricing oil in dollars and switch to euros or a basket of currencies. By 2004 to 2005, other proposals seriously discussed included setting up a global oil exchange in Iran to rival London and New York, establishing a Middle East regional currency, the gold dinar, and rallying around an ACU, Asian currency unit, anchored by the Japanese yen. The United States enjoyed some respite in 2005 as the dollar gained strength from Federal Reserve Board interest rate hikes. Washington also directed attention toward the Asian nations whose central banks were rapidly accumulating dollars and U.S. Treasury debt: Japan, China, Taiwan, and South Korea. In contrast to the greenbacks OPEC received in payment for oil imports, these stalwart exporters collected them for automobiles, television sets, laptops, advanced technology, and in China's case, in part for filling half of the shelves at Walmart. By late 2004, Asian central bankers had become nervous enough about the U.S. current account deficit. Would it break the dollar or oblige Washington to curb imports? to head off any imminent crisis by buying $200 billion worth of Treasury debt in the fourth quarter alone. In contrast to the gambits of OPEC malcontents, there was no East Asian plot to break the dollar. On the contrary, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan were longtime U.S. allies, well accustomed to sheltering under the U.S. military umbrella. However, their motivations were more complex than presumed by conservative economists, given to happy theories about the United States' fortunate ability to access a new transnational savings pool. As adherents of commercial realpolitik have argued, the Asian nations tend to follow national strategies of economic self-aggrandizement. In these systems, the visible hand of government often manages a stronger international grasp than the so-called invisible hand. One can only imagine the private conversations, the blunt economic language, in the conference rooms of Asian financiers and exporters, each group as confident of its contingent's coming hour as executives in Manhattan and Chicago circa 1919 were of America's. Why don't the Americans take care of their industry and invest in it? Why do they dither over primitive and anti-scientific religion? Why are their children so far behind our own students? Why can't they cut back on their foolish and unaffordable overconsumption of oil? How far can we, should we, support them? Satisfactory rebuttals are elusive. The implosion of American manufacturing, while hardly planned, has manifestly been tolerated in the U.S. capital. Since the mid-1990s, as China has reemerged in the world economy, its massive, minimal-wage labor force has sat on any chance of a broad U.S. manufacturing reemergence.